You are working on the inpatient hospital medicine team, and Matthew, a 21-year-old college student, is being admitted from the emergency department. He was brought in by his roommate during finals week. His roommate noted that he found him vomiting in the bathroom. He seemed really confused, and it seemed like he wet himself. His roommate confirms that he did not drink any alcohol because he has a big exam later today. On your physical exam, you note that Matthew is groaning and clutching his stomach. He is breathing deeply with a respiratory rate of 24 breaths per minute, and you note a fruity breath odor. Labs return with a greatly elevated blood glucose, low sodium, high potassium, and metabolic acidosis with increased anion gap. Also has positive glucose and ketones in his urine. You note that in the emergency department, he had received a few boluses of normal saline and then a continuous infusion of it. His serum glucose remains extremely elevated, but a bit improved, and his sodium and potassium levels are improving too. You write orders for admission, including IV fluids and an insulin drip. The nurse asks you to verify the orders, confirming that you meant to add supplemental potassium chloride to his IV fluids, even though his potassium is still elevated at 5.5 milligrams per deciliter. As you consider your orders, you wonder, should I wait longer to start these fluids, or is it wise to start adding potassium at this point? Consider your answers as we begin this next episode. Welcome to AudioBricks. I'm Adam Weinstein, bringing endocrinology from our bricks to your ears. Let's get started demonstrating how kids are not little adults. But first, a quick shout out to the learning platform that makes AudioBricks possible, the RX Bricks, which is the source of all content you hear on this podcast. And if you've been holding off on checking this out, well, now we're running the Bricks Season Pass campaign. If you follow the link in the show notes below, you can get 3 months of Bricks for the price of one, or a full year of Bricks for the price of 3 months. And simply clicking on the link helps support AudioBricks and the work we do to bring you the podcast, so we'll be happy if you even just take a look. After completing this episode, you will be able to 1. Define diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, and present an overview of the risk factors for DKA. 2. Describe the presenting signs and symptoms of DKA and its pathophysiology, and explain how they relate to each other. 3. Discuss common laboratory findings at presentation and during treatment of DKA. And 4. Outline the management of DKA. Part 1. What is diabetic ketoacidosis? Diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, is a life-threatening acute complication of diabetes mellitus, in particular type 1 diabetes mellitus. This metabolic syndrome is a combination of severe hyperglycemia, hypovolemia, and metabolic acidosis, and is a medical emergency. DKA is sometimes the first sign that a patient has with type 1 diabetes. Patients with known diabetes may also develop DKA if they miss doses of insulin or if they have an intervening physiologic stressor like an infection that raises basal insulin requirements. Other factors that may lead to a risk for DKA are also those that lead to increased insulin demands, including pregnancy and certain medications such as glucocorticoids. Part 2. What is the clinical presentation of diabetic ketoacidosis? Patients with DKA arrive at the emergency department looking quite ill, though many of the symptoms and findings may be nonspecific, such as vomiting, diarrhea, disordered breathing, and mental status changes, sometimes even unconsciousness. There is often a recent history of acute illness like pneumonia, urinary tract infection, or another physiologic stressor. These stressors increase insulin demands and therefore the risk for DKA. DKA is a systemic condition and critical illness, and affects every body system, especially the renal, cardiovascular, neurologic, and respiratory systems. Patients with DKA are dehydrated, related to the osmotic diuresis from their hyperglycosuria. The glucose in the urine acts as an effective osmole in the renal tubular lumen and draws water and electrolytes into the urine. This is what leads to such a high urine volume, or polyuria, as well as the high electrolyte losses leading to severe volume depletion. The decrease in blood volume results in dry mucous membranes and decreased skin turgor, as well as tachycardia, which is the body's attempt to maintain cardiac output. The low volume, though, may also lead to hypotension and low cardiac output, causing fatigue, dizziness, confusion, and a change in mental status. Abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting are also classic symptoms of patients with DKA. And of course, the vomiting worsens the dehydration already present. These symptoms may be related to the state of ketoacidosis, and fortunately, they do often resolve with correction of the ketoacidosis. Patients with DKA also breathe faster and more deeply. This is because in DKA, there is a buildup of ketoacids, leading to a metabolic acidosis and a drop in serum pH. The lungs will compensate for the acidemia through tachypnea and a labored form of hyperventilation known as Kussmaul breathing. Additional symptoms may include muscle cramps, which could be either due to glucagon-induced breakdown of muscle and/or from electrolyte abnormalities. A fruity breath odor may also be present, and this comes from the increased ketone bodies and acetone in the blood, which are exhaled through the lungs. Let's stop for a quick question to review your knowledge. Why do patients in DKA breathe deeply? Kussmaul respirations are a form of hyperventilation to compensate for the metabolic acidosis. Part 3. What is the pathophysiology of diabetic ketoacidosis? DKA occurs when there is an insufficient amount of insulin to manage basal metabolic requirements. This is why DKA is much more common in patients with type 1 diabetes who have no or minimal endogenous insulin than in those with type 2 diabetes. The low insulin levels leads to hyperglycemia and secretion of insulin counter-regulatory hormones, which are hormones that normally aim to raise blood sugar, opposing the actions of insulin. These hormones include glucagon, cortisol, catecholamines, and growth hormone. They are stimulated because the body's cells are perceiving a deficiency of glucose. Without insulin, the elevated glucose in the blood is unable to move intracellularly, and so the body's cells thinks the body needs more glucose when it's just the opposite. Therefore, because of this counter-regulatory response, insulin deficiency leads to hyperglycemia through a variety of mechanisms. These include decreased tissue uptake of glucose, increased glycogenolysis, and increased gluconeogenesis. Glucagon, one of the counter-regulatory hormones I mentioned, breaks down glycogen stored in fat cells in the liver, or glycogenolysis. Glucagon also stimulates conversion of triglycerides to free fatty acids, leading to ketogenesis and an increase in ketones and ketoacids in the blood and an increase in anion gap, causing a metabolic acidosis. A mnemonic that may help you recall glucagon's role is, glucagon's effects are what you would expect if the glucose is gone. Ketoacids are normally formed from free fatty acids in the liver when the body is in a state of starvation and needs emergency energy. In DKA, the low insulin and high glucagon lead the liver to make ketones, even though the patient is not actually starving. The liver converts fatty acids through acetyl coenzyme A into ketone bodies as an alternative source of energy. Many different cell types can use ketones as a source of energy in situations when glucose is unavailable. In DKA, the ketones are produced in such large amounts, so they are not used up, and instead they circulate at high levels, leading to ketoacidosis, a form of increased anion gap metabolic acidosis. We discussed briefly before how the high circulating glucose leads to increased glucose in the urine, or glycosuria. There is so much glucose filtered into the renal tubules that it amounts too great for the proximal convoluted tubule to reabsorb. In this situation, glucose is acting as an effective osmole in the renal tubule, increasing renal tubular fluid osmolality, causing water to be pulled in the tubule. This increases urine volume and is a phenomenon called osmotic diuresis, leading to excess urination. Because water is not able to be reabsorbed out of the renal tubules, this impairs reabsorption of a variety of electrolytes, including sodium, potassium, and phosphate, which in turn depletes the patient of these electrolytes. The high sodium losses lead to signs of volume depletion, like hypotension and tachycardia. Phosphate depletion, if severe, can lead to muscle weakness. And with all this potassium lost in the urine, you would think there would also be hypokalemia, but this is not necessarily the case. Thinking back to potassium homeostasis, you'll recall that most of the body's potassium lives in cells. In the setting of the acidemia caused by the ketoacidosis, to mitigate the low pH in the blood, hydrogen ions will shift intracellularly in exchange for potassium. So, in DKA, potassium shifts out of the cells and into the blood, causing hyperkalemia, even in the setting of high losses of potassium in the urine. This potassium shifting may happen for two additional reasons in DKA as well. First, remember that insulin normally stimulates the sodium-potassium ATPase to pump potassium into cells and sodium out of cells. So a lack of insulin means this pump is less active, shifting the potassium balance into the blood. And second, in the setting of insulin deficiency, the glucose in the blood can act as an effective osmole, so the hyperglycemia increases the serum osmolality, pulling water out of all the cells, and potassium follows along because of this osmotic shift. So this is pretty remarkable. Even though the patient has a low total body potassium because of the very high urinary losses in DKA, the patient may present with an elevated serum potassium level. Maybe we were right to add potassium to our patient Matthew's IV fluids? Let's confirm our knowledge with a question break. Is the serum potassium and total body potassium most often increased or decreased in DKA? In most patients presenting with DKA, the serum potassium level is elevated, but the total body potassium is decreased. Part 4. How do we diagnose diabetic ketoacidosis? While DKA is often recognizable from its presenting symptoms, the diagnosis is best confirmed with laboratory findings. Given that DKA presents with hyperglycemia, hypovolemia, and ketoacidosis, the typical laboratory confirmation needed includes serum electrolytes, BUN, creatinine, and glucose, as well as urinalysis testing for glucose and ketones. A blood gas is also useful to assess the severity of the acidemia. While blood ketone levels can be tested directly, this is often unnecessary, as the urinary ketones and the calculation of the increased anion gap in the blood are sufficient for the diagnosis. Let's try another question break. What is the primary acid-base disturbance in DKA? The primary acid-base disturbance in DKA is an increased anion gap metabolic acidosis. In DKA, electrolyte abnormalities are extremely common, so we are often assessing serum sodium, potassium, bicarbonate, phosphate, and magnesium on diagnosis, as well as throughout the treatment course. As noted earlier, in the absence of insulin, the high serum glucose acts as an effective osmole, causing a high serum osmolality, drawing water out of cells, diluting the serum sodium concentration, and leading to hyponatremia. Even though there is hyponatremia, the patient technically has hyperosmolality, so we would expect to see signs and symptoms of hyperosmolality rather than hypoosmolality. Again, patients with DKA often present with hyperkalemia, even though total body potassium stores are low, because of the shift of potassium out of cells. It's important to note they have low total body potassium because the serum potassium level will fall quite quickly, and sometimes markedly, during treatment with insulin, which transports potassium back into the cells. So patients are at risk for hypokalemia with insulin treatment. So potassium repletion is needed because overall stores are decreased. Because of high losses of magnesium and phosphate in the urine, hypomagnesemia and hypophosphatemia may also be present in DKA and may require repletion. Like potassium, insulin treatment also leads to increased phosphate transport into cells, further aggravating the hypophosphatemia and making phosphate repletion particularly important. As DKA is associated with hypovolemia, often severe, it may be associated with acute kidney injury due to decreased renal perfusion. The blood urea nitrogen level and serum creatinine will be elevated and is typically corrected with volume repletion. Part 5. How do we manage diabetic ketoacidosis? DKA is a critical illness with hypovolemia and critical electrolyte abnormalities that may be fatal if untreated. The most common causes of death are cerebral edema from rapid fluid shifts and cardiac arrest from electrolyte abnormalities. The management of DKA requires close monitoring and adjustments, and often requires intensive care unit hospitalization. Prompt recognition and treatment normally produces a good outcome without long-term sequelae. The first goal for therapy in DKA is volume repletion. Dehydration and volume loss in DKA can be so severe that patients require 5 to 10 liters or more of fluid resuscitation. Patients should be treated with isotonic saline to preferentially resuscitate the extracellular volume. Isotonic saline will improve hemodynamic function, such as blood pressure, as well as improve renal perfusion and the glomerular filtration rate, which aids in excretion of the elevated serum glucose and ketones. The other mainstay of treatment for DKA is insulin. Insulin allows glucose to enter cells, correcting the hyperglycemia and getting to the source of the metabolic problem. Insulin will also inhibit glucagon, reducing glucose formation from glycogen stores, and it will shut off ketone production, correcting the metabolic acidosis. Insulin is typically started once treatment of the severe hypovolemia has started and the patient is hemodynamically stable with evidence of good organ perfusion. In the setting of DKA, insulin is administered intravenously as a continuous drip to provide better control, predictable delivery, and the ability to fine-tune the rate and make adjustments. Because treatment with fluid resuscitation and insulin is so effective at correcting the hyperglycemia, the serum glucose level may drop too low. So counterintuitively, once the serum glucose level drops into the 200 mg per deciliter range, dextrose should be added to the fluids to prevent hypoglycemia. When the ketones are no longer present in the blood, and if the patient can eat, transition to subcutaneous insulin may be accomplished. And for the emphasis again, potassium is one of the most crucial electrolytes to monitor in the treatment of DKA. Remember, patients are often hyperkalemic at presentation of DKA and may have associated electrocardiographic changes, such as peak T waves or even arrhythmias. The hyperkalemia will resolve with insulin treatment, and because the patient has total body potassium depletion, hypokalemia can quickly develop, which may also cause electrocardiographic changes, such as U waves, or if severe, life-threatening cardiac arrhythmias too. To avoid hypokalemia during insulin treatment, potassium should be added to the IV fluids before the serum potassium drops below 5 to 5.5 milliequivalents per liter. Hypophosphatemia and hypomagnesemia also occur with DKA. Some centers use protocols to replete phosphate as well and give IV potassium in the form of potassium phosphate, but this is not consistent across centers. Magnesium supplementation can be given if the level is less than 2 mg per deciliter. Let's review our management discussion with one last question. What is used for volume repletion in the initial treatment of DKA? The initial treatment of hypovolemia and DKA is achieved with an isotonic crystalloid solution, typically normal saline. And that's all I have today for diabetic ketoacidosis. So let's see if we've completed our goals for this episode. Can you define diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, and present an overview of the risk factors for DKA? Diabetic ketoacidosis is a severe, acute complication of diabetes mellitus, more common in type 1 diabetes, leading to hyperglycemia, hypovolemia, and ketoacidosis. Common risk factors for DKA include lack of insulin or an increased physiologic stress, such as an infection, increasing basal insulin requirements. Next, can you describe the presenting signs and symptoms of DKA? Common presenting symptoms of DKA include abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, and signs of hypovolemia, such as tachycardia, hypotension, decreased skin turgor, dry mucous membranes, and loss of mental acuity. Kussmaul breathing is the hyperventilation that occurs as patients attempt to get rid of the excess carbon dioxide related to the acidosis. Can you describe the pathophysiology of DKA? DKA results from a lack of adequate insulin coupled with the activation of counter-regulatory hormones leading to hyperglycemia, osmotic diuresis causing hypovolemia, and increased ketone production causing a metabolic acidosis. Now, can you discuss common laboratory findings at presentation and during treatment of DKA? Common laboratory findings include hyperglycemia, increased urine glucose and ketones, increased anion gap metabolic acidosis, hyponatremia, and hyperkalemia on presentation, but hypokalemia during treatment. Hypomagnesemia and hypophosphatemia are typical findings as well. And lastly, can you outline the management of DKA? Management for DKA includes fluid resuscitation, insulin, and potassium supplementation. Careful monitoring of and attention must be given to electrolyte abnormalities that may occur during treatment. Armed with your newfound knowledge of diabetic ketoacidosis, let's revisit our patient's story from the beginning of this episode. As you may recall, we have just admitted Matthew, a 21-year-old college student, to the hospital with DKA. The nurse notes he prescribed potassium to be added to his IV fluids despite his elevated serum potassium level. As you consider your orders, you wonder, should I wait longer to start these fluids, or is it wise to start adding potassium at this point? You recall that even though his serum potassium is elevated, his total body potassium stores are decreased. Therefore, as you are about to begin insulin treatment, you are cognizant that his serum potassium might fall significantly, leading to hypokalemia. You thank the nurse for their question and explain the reason for this approach so you all have a shared understanding of the plan and the findings to monitor for. And that's all I have for today's audio brick. Thanks for joining me. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up or a comment. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. And again, now's your chance to take advantage of the Brick Season Pass offer by following the link in the show notes below. It's a huge discount on the written material that serves as the foundation of Audio Bricks, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already and help keep Audio Bricks free. Stay healthy out there!